It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning, Q.
Another week without Maria.
Maria, she's got the avian flu or something.
I don't know.
It's pretty bad. She's still stuck at home with the fever.
Yeah. So we're keeping her fingers crossed. It looks like she'll be back next week, but I hate making predictions like that.
You know, yeah, I know. Send her your best.
That's right. All right. Well, plenty to cover this week, and it looks like, I don't know, I guess I'm not really surprised, but it looks like the monorail is going for another vote.
Yeah, we do this every year. We're going to be doing it next year and the year after that and the year after that as well. It'll be the new monorail. It'll be the improved monorail the next year.
Yep.
No, it's been a fascinating game of chicken this week with the between the monorail board and the city council and the mayor's office. The mayor's office and the city council hold all the cards because they have the permits. So the monorail board eventually bent to the will and decided to put a measure on the November ballot. The board really, I think, has been acting fairly irresponsibly in terms of they've been highly resistant to the idea of changing the original 14-mile proposal. Then what will be on the ballot in November is a shortened route. They've cut off the three stops going to Crown Hill at the north and then one stop in West Seattle in the south, so that it'll start in Inner Bay now at Dreyfus and 15th and then go to Alaska Junction in West Seattle. But the problem is that they don't have any cost estimates for that yet, and hopefully they will in a couple of weeks now. But they don't have any of that worked up because the monorail board, that is, don't have any of those figures worked up. It's remarkable that they don't have those cost estimates, that they haven't had those contingencies in case they needed to go with a shorter route, because we've been talking about this for months and months now. It's just remarkable that we don't have an estimate of how much the cost savings for that is, how far into the future the bonds will have to go in order to pay that off, and commensurately how long the car tab tax will have to go on in order to pay that off. The board is saying, well, we'll have that in a few weeks. We don't have that yet.
I think it's because Joel Horn took off with all that, didn't he? All the paperwork?
Seriously? I don't.
I wouldn't put it past him.
I wouldn't either. It really bespeaks that they haven't been taking this seriously. I don't think they haven't prepared the cost estimates. They haven't known what the alternatives are ahead of time. And so when they get their backs up against the wall, as they were originally, the deadline was supposed to be a Wednesday night meeting, and then it got pushed back to Thursday, and then it got pushed back to yesterday, and then into the afternoon, and they finally met 4 hours after the city council had met, and then reversed an earlier vote and decided to put it on the November ballot. It was a desperation move. It was a move where they didn't have the information that they needed to have in order to actually make the decision. So it really shows that the people on the monorail board are the true believers, the people, and you can understand it, the people who really want to see the vision kept to its original promise, and that's simply not going to happen at this point. We've well established now that the original financing proposal wasn't going to fly, and that it was so far off between where it was and where it needed to be that the only two alternatives were either to raise the tax or to shorten the line, and they went with a proposal to shorten the line.
So it is at this point, but a shorter line is what is up for a vote.
Exactly, a okay. Shorter line. This is a 10-mile line. It will be up for a vote in the November ballot.
Okay, so. Well, and it's still obviously a very contentious issue, and there's plenty of people that are still very supportive, regardless of financing or
yeah. It's again, it you know, I don't think it's ever a good idea to accept a public works proposal on faith that way. A public transit system is not in and of itself sexy because of the technology. You know, it's the sort of thing where when you're talking about that much money and that much money in the public trust, you have to have accountability. You have to have some sense of where the money is going and how it's being spent and who's managing it. And you know, there have been for far too long, there have been too many people willing to look the other way because they're enamored with the idea. They're enamored with the idea of the monorail as being something that, you know, Seattle exclusively is doing. It's something that's identified with the city because of the World's Fair monorail. You know, it's something that that people really like the concept of. And, you know, you can understand that to some degree, and to some degree it is a more appropriate technology than light rail. You know, the arguments are in many ways valid, but that doesn't excuse what's happened to the project and how it's been sent awry by its managers and the people we entrusted it with.
Well, I didn't actually, we didn't go over what on this particular issue, but we did just have some elections, and we're still waiting for a lot of the votes to come in, I guess, from the people that mailed them in and stuff. But monorail board, two of the spots were up for election, and it looked like the current front runners are people that wanted to shut it down.
Yeah, and the incumbents did very poorly. They got well the candidates who wanted to shut it down, Beth Goldberg in one race and Jim Nobles in the other, got well over 50% of the vote, I believe.
So far. We still have a significant chunk
waiting
to come in. So the returns are still early.
The returns are still early, which is another issue all in itself. But, you know, that we should have to wait weeks to find out what the actual count is on an election. But
we'll start seeing candidates for the following election before we see the results of the current
election. Well, yeah, because there's only a certain number of weeks between the primary and the general election, and you know, you got to have the votes counted from one before you can have the other.
So far, the
results show that there's a very heavy anti-monorail sentiment in the voters now. It's going to be a very uphill battle in November for the monorail to survive, I think.
But overall as well, in terms of candidates across the board, it looked like incumbents are, although they did better than most, they still didn't have the numbers that many people anticipated that they would. For instance,
it's a general rule in primaries that if an incumbent gets less than 50% of the vote, they're vulnerable. The idea being that people are looking for somebody else, anybody else, and that those votes are diffused among a number of candidates in the primary, but in a general election where it's one person versus another, the non-incumbent tends to benefit from that. And what we saw in the city council races, for example, is that none of the three incumbents got more than 50% of the vote. Richard McIver was under 40%, in fact, in a three-way race. So those McIver and then in the other races, Richard Conlon and Jan Drago are all to some degree vulnerable in November.
And yeah, especially Drago's race, I've found interesting because you look at the number of people that voted for Angel Bolaños and Linda Averill was at about 15% and 18% from last what I saw. Mm-hmm. And if you combine those two together, that would be right in the ballpark for competing against both Core and Jan Drago.
Yeah, and that was a shame because Bolaños and Averill were the two most progressive people in the city council races overall, and they were running against each other, so they split a number of votes between them, I'm sure. They could have gone to one progressive candidate.
All right. Well, bouncing back to the Seattle School District, Seattle High Schools, I understand this week that there was a significant option that was put forward to 18-year-old high schoolers.
Yeah, and credit Mike Dietrich for this. He was the person who brought this to the attention of the school board that a ruling came down within the Bush administration over the past month that in the past for the opt-out forms for military recruiters, students had to get under the age of 18 had to get their parents' permission in order to not have the information forwarded to military recruiters on, you know, personal information on, you know, age and academic background and, you know, all the other things that that get sent from the school district. And it now turns out that students can do that themselves. High school juniors and high school seniors under the age of 18 can sign their own opt-out forms It's in a packet that the school district sent out. I believe the deadline for returning it back is sometime in the middle of next month.
It's October 10th.
October 10th, yeah. But that is something that up until the school board meeting this week, they didn't know that they could do. So I believe the school district is going to try and design and send out in the next couple of weeks a separate form that students can use for that.
I think they're working on it as we speak. It's supposed to go out, I think, next week was what
I
read. But
good.
And I also understand this is also happening in other school districts. I know Edmonds has got the same thing where they just had worked on that. So it seems to be a trend that's moving across the country.
Yeah, and that's it's a very welcome trend, too. Chicago and New York had had that for several months, and activists here had been pressuring the school district to allow students to be able to do that for some time, and it finally got the go-ahead this week.
All right. Well, also this week, it looks like there's some controversy sticking with the Seattle School Board that there might be some rule changes in terms of public expressing their opinions at meetings.
Yeah, and this is one that I have kind of a mixed sentiment on. It's been coming for a while because anybody who's ever been to a school board meeting in the past, I'd say 3 or 4 years, knows that they tended to degenerate into circuses during the public comment period. People singing during testimony, people ranting and raving on you know whatever the issues are, and they don't have to be issues that the school board is considering or is anywhere near considering. But the school board, I think, overplayed its hand and overreacted a little bit in proposing a rule change that would limit public comment to agenda matters at hand for the school board. And it's really raised a ruckus from people citing, you know, free speech restrictions and yada, yada, yada. And, you know, it seems like there would have to be some sort of middle ground somewhere where you can have public comment. And the public comment is limited to 3 minutes as it is. So, it's the number of people that are signed up, so you can have it go on for an hour or so at the beginning of each school board meeting, and you know you can just see the school board members just rolling their eyes and not taking public comment seriously when that's what it's there for is to be taken seriously. You know, these are the constituents, these are the people they need to be hearing from, so. So hopefully the new measure will the new rules will not be enacted. I don't you know, they've gotten so much grief from them that I don't think they will they will enact them. But at the same time, there needs to be some responsibility from the people who are signing up for the public comment periods for these members. You know, not to take this scenario seriously, you know, to give it a level of decorum that they're not giving it now.
All right. Jumping to national issues, John Roberts moves a step closer to being on the Supreme Court this week.
Yeah, and, you know, watching the Democrats play Hamlet with this and one person saying, I'm going to vote for him, and the next time I'm going to vote against him, and, you know, all the... You know, announcing their portentous votes as though anybody cares what their votes are going to be, because Roberts is going to be confirmed. And the only way he was ever not going to be confirmed is if the Democrats filibustered and put up a real fight. And the fact that they did not put up a real fight means that nobody really cares how Harry Reid votes or how John Kerry votes or how Ted Kennedy votes or how any of these different Democratic senators vote. It's a moot point. And at the same time, you know, Roberts really hasn't said anything during his confirmation hearings, unlike all of the other Supreme Court justices during their nomination hearings. You know, were fairly forthcoming with their views on different topics, with their personal histories and how those influenced their judicial philosophies, and you know all the other various things that you put out during your nomination hearings. Roberts really didn't say anything. This guy is a blank slate. And a lot of people are fearing the worst because of that. You know, I don't particularly think we're going to get the worst. I think he'll be bad, but he won't be, you know, he'll be bad because, you know, he's a Bush nominee, and Bush wouldn't have picked him if he didn't have certain expectations for you know, how he would rule. But at the same time, I think it should have been incumbent on him to be a lot more forthcoming than he has been. And the Democrats really, I think, missed an opportunity to make a statement saying that, you know, the White House shouldn't be able to get away with this. The White House has been withholding documents relating to Robert's history. They've been doing this routinely with information that congressional Democrats want. And Democrats at some point need to make a stand. And this would have been as good a time as any, because it's something important to Bush. And, you know, Bush has a certain amount of pressure with a new judicial season opening soon, and John Paul Stevens being the ranking and a very liberal Supreme Court justice who would have been in line to become the acting Chief Justice had Roberts not been voted in. If the Democrats had held that up, they would have had a real bargaining chip there for getting some behavior out of the White House that the White House has not been willing to do. But at the same time, you know, the Democrats are the Democrats, so they're not going to do that. They're gonna be wimps, and they're gonna be more concerned with their own image than they are with playing effective hardball politics like the Republicans do, and that's why the Republicans keep winning.
I like that image, judicial season. It kind of reminds me of like hunting season, where we should all be wearing bright yellow vests.
Yes,
so we
exactly.
Don't get shot.
Yes, we need to protect ourselves. Yes.
All right, moving along. The FDA commissioner said goodbye this week.
Yes, Lester Crawford is resigning, and we don't know why right now. It's certainly not because he hasn't been doing the will of the Bush administration. Crawford's reign at the FDA over the past year, he's been acting commissioner. He was only really confirmed as a full-time, fully vested commissioner 2 months ago. But he had been acting commissioner for a year before that, and then second in command as a deputy commissioner for a couple of years before that. A veterinarian, what a veterinarian is doing as the head of the Food and Drug Administration is, you know, it's like putting somebody at who's done horse shows at the head of FEMA or something ridiculous like that. But under his rule at the FDA, it's been extremely controversial, and the reason it's been controversial is because time after time after time, you've had politics trumping science. You've had it with Plan B, the oral contraceptive that was supposed to go to over-the-counter sales that's been held up because of objections from the religious far right. You've had it with Vioxx and the lack of protection for the public around that. You've had all these different controversies that have been the result of having a regulatory agency that's in bed with the industry that it's supposed to be regulating. In this case, the pharmaceutical industry and big agribusiness. And this is what Crawford has been up to, and this is again an opportunity for when the new commissioner is named by the Bush administration, for the Democrats who have to approve that nomination process to really press the Bush White House and the new nominee to not let politics trump science, to let the science you know, have its day.
All right. Moving along, I missed it, but luckily you caught it. The U.S. is looking at resuming production of landmines.
Yeah, Congress is going to vote in December on this. It's called the SPIDER system. Now, there have been unconfirmed reports since May in Iraq, and I mean, this might be an item for this week in Iraq, but I'll mention it now, that another system called Matrix, using technology that's being developed for SPIDER, supposedly has been deployed in Iraq since last May. But the Bush administration released a policy paper last February 2004, a year ago February, that is, that essentially reversed about a decade of progress toward abolition of landmines in the U.S. The U.S. is not a party to the the Mine Ban Treaty of 1997, the Ottawa Convention. 145 countries have ratified, another 8 have signed but not yet ratified. The United States is not among those countries, but it had been honoring it up until now. But again, the Bush administration has reversed it. The Pentagon saying that landmines fulfill an essential military function. That's almost a direct quote from the policy paper. And so we're going against the standards of the rest of the world yet again by potentially resuming production of landmines. Now, the deal is that this has not yet been approved by Congress. It goes up for a vote in December. So now would be a very, very good time to contact your elected representative, contact Maria Cantwell, contact Patty Murray, contact Jim McDermott or whoever your representative is in the House, and urge them not to support the new generation of landmines, because this is a barbaric weapon. This is a weapon that kills and maims for many years after it's been deployed, and long after the armed conflicts have been relegated to history. It continues to kill, and people in the rest of the world are moving on. Militaries around the world have said, we don't need this weapon. We'll live without it. And the Pentagon can do the same.
I know the Pentagon's justification for wanting to move forward with this particular program with the spider network or weapons is because they say, well, these are actually detonated remotely. They have somebody watching the system. They put out all these mines, and they have somebody watching a console or something. But the reality being that they can, when they're busy, they can walk away and just arm all of them, and then be done with it, and they act exactly like regular landmines. So
yeah.
All right. Well, moving along. Robert Fisk, a very excellent writer, has had a little trouble trying to get into the U.S.
Yeah, he was supposed to speak in New Mexico this week. He got a flight from Toronto to Denver, and supposedly his papers were not in order. Now those papers were probably the papers that get sold with his byline in them. Those were the papers that were considered to not be in order. He's a very, very well-known Middle East correspondent who's been harshly critical of the United States invasion of Iraq and our policy toward Palestine, to name only two areas in which he's been critical over the years. And it's not just that he's been critical, but he's been one of the few reporters who's been willing to report on the ground from outside the green zone in Iraq and really break the information embargo that the United States has been eager to enforce on what's going on in Iraq. He's a wonderful, wonderful source of information. And it's not surprising that the U.S. government and the Bush administration does not appreciate that and does not like him for that reason. I can't believe this is anything but political payback for what he's put out over the years.
Yeah, saying his papers aren't in order. I mean, here's a guy that hops on planes more than just about anybody else I could think of.
Yeah,
probably more than most diplomats.
Yeah, he's crossed more borders than I don't know, but I mean he's clearly he knows the process. That's simply ludicrous.
All right. Well, then that takes us to This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
We had the remarkable spectacle this week of the British government breaking into a jail in Basra in order to break out two of their Secret Service operatives who had been arrested. Now, that got a lot of media coverage, but what did not get coverage in that little melee and the demonstrations and near riots in Basra and other cities in southern Iraq that followed was that was pretty much a tit-for-tat arrangement, because the previous day what had happened was that the British had arranged for the arrest of Muqtadir al-Sadr's head in southern Iraq in the Basra region, and that had led the Shiite militias that were that normally don't get along well with al-Sadr's militias, that had led them to arrest the Secret Service operatives in Iraq. So it was very much a tit for tat kind of thing, and showing once again what a powder keg that region is. Even a part of the country that it had been considered relatively stable and relatively peaceful over the past 2 years, You know, there's a lot of resentment of the British and American occupiers there. Another interesting development this week that got virtually no media coverage was the pending arrest of the former defense minister under Ayad Alawi, under that regime, when the U.S. Was still directly administering as opposed to the indirect administration that's going on now, when the U.S. had its viceroy in power in Baghdad. Ayad Alawi's defense minister, who is now living in Jordan, is wanted for embezzling somewhere between $1 and $2.3 billion, that's billion with a B, dollars, from monies that were supposed to go into training and arming an Iraqi defense forces. So this is a good clue as to why you've been hearing Maria talk for these many months and years about how the Iraqi soldiers don't have adequate arms, how they don't have equipment from training and all the other. Even though all this money has been pouring in, supposedly from American taxpayers, to pay for this stuff, it's been going into the pockets of the Iraqi defense minister and his cronies and probably many other people too. So this is a welcome development that this guy might be prosecuted for this crime, but there's probably a lot of other people that need to be prosecuted too.
All right. Anything else from Iraq?
No, not right now.
All right. Just a couple minutes left, and wanted to mention that one of the fallouts of the current storm down in Texas, Rita, in addition to all the damage that it's doing, the Galveston, which I was surprised to hear before we went live that you actually had lived in Galveston.
Yeah, I lived in Galveston for 3 years. I was teaching in a medical school there, actually.
Well, it's funny that you did teach there, because that happens to also be the home of one of the new BSL Biosafety Level 4 facilities.
University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston.
That our current administration is seeing fit to fund. And those, of course, house the most deadly pathogens known on the planet.
Yeah. Put it right in the path of a hurricane.
Yeah.
That's smart.
And I understand Galveston regularly gets storms through there.
Well, yeah, so. Galveston was the site of the worst natural disaster in the history of the United States. Some 12,000 people died in the year 1900. When the entire city was swamped by it's on a low-lying island. The entire city was swamped by the storm surge from a hurricane.
Yeah.
So these things happen every few years. There was a tropical storm in 2001. There's a full-blown hurricane that I lived through in 1983. So they do happen.
Yeah. So defense critic Richard Ebright, biodefense critic Richard Ebright, who's very knowledgeable and outspoken on this issue, said about the wisdom of putting a facility like that down in Galveston was about one notch better than putting it on the hillside of Mount St. Helens. So.
Which is a beautiful line. So they've been spending all this week evacuating that facility and killing off the animals
and pathogens and erasing hundreds of millions of dollars worth of work.
Yeah, I mean, regardless of what you think of that type of work, the waste of taxpayer money of losing all of that work regularly
by locating when
the storms is just insane. Yeah, you're right.
All right. Well, events this week, one today, one Thursday.
Yeah, we got a rally coming up today, and you know, and I wish the peace groups in this town would all get together and get behind the same rally at the same time. This is an answer event. Mm-hmm. Snow and the church council are not participating, but I think it'll be large anyway. It's in conjunction with a very large rally that's happening in Washington D.C. today at the same time. Sidney Sheehan speaking and a number of other celebrities and new celebrities, and we'll have our own rally here. It'll be noon at Westlake, and they'll be marching somewhere. I don't know exactly where, but
there's a feeder march actually that starts at 10:30 at Seattle Central.
Oh, okay.
That goes down to
that.
A noon rally at Westlake, and then the march itself goes from 1:30 to 2:30. So,
okay, and where's the march going to?
I believe down to the usual spot, the Federal Building.
Okay.
So, you know, they never tell us for sure where things are going. So,
we'll just follow
quickly.
Yes.
Thursday.
Yes. And then Thursday, there's an event on alternative electoral politics with Green Party presidential candidate David Cobb, for the three or four of you who voted for him. That will be at the Labor Temple at 7:00. And there'll be other people there also, various panelists. So Check it out.
All right. Talking once again with Job Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And quickly, where can people find Eat the State?
You can find it anywhere you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, places like that. You can also find it on the web at www.eatthestate.org.